As always, this show is brought to you by Mass Monopoly. We're an adventure sports agency focused on fueling the brands that fuel us. Everyone here is an adventure athlete of some sort and is active in some or all of the sports we support. We help build adventure brands through authentic, value-based marketing, growing your business without selling your soul. Go to massmonopoly.com for a free consultation. We're also brought to you by 508.com. Whether you're an adventure sport fanatic or just starting out, 508.com is a great place to outfit your family for adventures. Started by a husband and wife duo with two very active boys who are always looking for a way to equip the four of them without breaking the bank. So, if you're looking for gloves to keep your fingers warm, pads to make the wipeouts easier, mud shields to keep your face shiny on the mountain bike, or a helmet to protect those precious noggins, all at family affordable prices, head over to 508.com. That's F-I-V-E, the letter O, the number 8. .com. My guest today is Ruben Torenbeek, founder and designer at Raw Mountain Bikes. With the release of the Madonna, Raw has one bike on the market, and judging by the reviews, people are loving it. He's worked some unique features into the frame set and given extra care to make sure these bikes are durable, like keep on riding and riding hard durable. We talked about everything from how the company came to be to assembling the very first bike. So without further ado... And we're off. We're recording. So thanks for joining me today. I'm excited that we get to have this talk. Your website, I see you updated it recently, and it looks really, really nice. I see new bikes are in stock, and there's a lot to talk about. But first, I think what I'd like to know is, how did you get into making mountain bikes? What led you to start the company in the first place?
Well, I've been riding bikes my whole life already. I finished my mechanical engineering degree, bachelor degree, and then started working in the bike industry through, starting after my engineering degree. So spent a few years at Ghost Bikes in Germany and then moved on to Scott in Switzerland.
Oh, cool.
As a bike engineer. And it's now about 2.5-3 years ago that I quit my job there to start engineering services. So that's a little bit how I started, just being self-employed.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 years ago, a lot of ideas came together on how I would want to build a mountain bike frame. And it was not that on one specific day I decided to start a bike company, but everything kind of came together, and at some point I decided to make a business plan to it to see if it would all make sense also financially. And it's now about nearly 2 years ago that I decided to do that full time. So it's been a crazy 2 years since then.
But I bet it has.
Very good. Yeah.
But that's good. I mean, the bikes are selling. I see you're getting some good reviews of the Madonna, which sounds like it rides awesome. So things are going pretty well so far. That's nice.
Yeah. It's been, so the brand got launched a year ago, and in spring I got the first stock, that were 100 frames. So I'm selling them now as frame kits. And these first, the first batch is now nearly sold out. So that's very good. People are very happy. Feedback is good. So yeah, it's, in a lot of things, it's also still like a big learning curve, but it's going good, and yeah, enjoying it.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a learning curve, but it's a fun place to be, right? Because mountain biking is exploding. I mean, it's still growing. The sport's getting bigger and bigger. So there's room for a lot of people to innovate, to make different bikes. It's nice because there's room to play. You know, there's other sports where it's a lot harder to make a dent. You know, if you were going to become a NFL pad manufacturer or something, that there's not a lot of space to play in, you know, American football or something. But
yeah,
mountain biking.
What I really like is that I really see that there are a lot of people that appreciate all the like technical details on a frame. Whereas, like, of course, it's a niche product that I make, so I'm not expecting the masses to understand why it's there. But there are so many mountain bikers nowadays that just spend so much time on understanding the product and riding it and appreciating all, let's say, like, yeah, the technical details of the product.
And what makes it so niche? What makes it a niche bike as opposed to something else?
Well, so I think it's in a category of what we call enduro mountain bikes, especially here in Europe. And my main focus has been on one hand, on the performance of the bike, so just geometry, suspension, those things, but also a lot on the durability. I think that is something that is just generally under. It's kind of normal right now that a full suspension mountain bike is going to need new bearings after a year of riding, and that after 2-3 years it's kind of done. And I think that it's come to a point where we all accepted that, but I don't think that's a good thing. So instead of only focusing on weight and trying to get something on the market real quick, I really want to have products that will have a long life and also deliver the performance on long term. So not just on the first few weeks of riding, but also after 2 or 3 seasons of riding.
Yeah, well, that's certainly interesting, because a nice enduro bike, they're not cheap. You know, to get a nice bike, it's a good chunk of change. So what is it that make your bikes last longer? What does it make them makes them more durable?
So on one hand, it's about the construction of the, so it's an aluminium frame. So on one hand, it's the construction of it. So in a way that it's just better able to transmit forces, especially, let's say, like from the rear wheel to the BB. So to the rider's feet, that's something very important. And then also, of course, the bearings, the complete hardware of the frame. And one of the things I do is that on all pivots of the frame, I've designed additional sealed caps around the bearings. So that means that you've got the seal on the bearing itself, but also an additional one around it. So that means that every bearing has like a double seal. That means that one frame gets 18 sealed caps on it. So that comes with a lot of effort, cost, and also a little bit of weight. But yeah, it definitely adds to the durability of the frame. And that way, like I said, also to the performance of the frame after a certain period of riding.
I would rather have some extra durability than worry about weight. I mean, for me, I want to ride the bike and I want to enjoy it. And like you said, I want to keep it longer if I can. I don't want a new bike every 2 years. And yeah. I think a lot of people, for some reason, get hung up on weight, and the weight difference between in the enduro class, the weight difference. I mean, you're talking about somewhere between a pound or two, maybe between like the lightest bikes and the heavier bikes. My backpack full of water weighs a lot more than that extra pound and a half. I would much rather focus on durability and comfort and feel than I would weight. Why do people focus so much on that?
I think in certain, like if you're a cross country racer or a road bike racer, it's definitely true that a lighter bike, even if it's only 200 grams or 500 grams, will help.
Yeah.
And also maybe not only, I mean, for a real racer on the clock, it will help, but also in the feel of the bike. So if you just ride your bike, I say like 2 times a month, and you're not really competing, it can still help in how the bike feels, like very aggressive. But that is like to road bikes and to cross country bikes. And I even think that on enduro bikes and downhill bikes, that the bike needs a certain amount of weight. So when you're riding down, you can feel that with a little bit of weight, a little bit of mass, especially if it's like central in the bikes in the frame, you can feel that the bike just keeps going a lot better. And suspension works better when a bike has a bit of weight. So it's something that I actually think is good. I don't think an enduro bike should be too light. And it's always, if you have that discussion with people, they will always say like, yeah, but you also have to pedal up the bike,
right?
But the thing is, like on the Madonna, the seat angle is very steep, so you've got a very central position when pedaling up the hill, and that is something that adds so much more to how easy the bike will pedal. And then there's also the bit of having a very efficient drivetrain with combined with the suspension. So it's like it's a complete package of things, and just only saying like the weight of a kilogram or 2 kilograms is not going to hold you back pedaling up.
No, certainly not. And it seems like Enduro is the class that everybody's after, right? Because it's the magic answer of downhill and able to climb.
Yeah.
Is that what took you into Enduro, or is it just that's the kind of riding you do, so that's what made you start with an Enduro bike?
Yeah, I've kind of done all kind of disciplines over the years. I was actually born in the Netherlands, living in Germany now. And in the Netherlands, I just used to ride cross country, did some trials, and then moved on to downhill riding, and also did the years of downhill racing. So it kind of, I think for me, it's the same as for a lot of people. Just everything comes together in what we now call enduro mountain biking. Mm-hmm. But in some way, I think that enduro mountain biking is just like what mountain biking is right now. Because you can do what I don't know what I could do a few years ago, and you can still pedal up a bike. So
yeah, and so much has changed. I mean, it's the enduro bikes nowadays are. They're better downhill than downhill bikes were a few years ago, and they're climbing as well as trail bikes were a couple of years ago.
Yeah,
they're
and
really.
Also I think something that is really interesting is that enduro bikes are easier to handle than downhill bikes in a lot of ways. So of course, if you get to extreme limits, the downhill bike will help. But in 90% of the descending, an enduro bike will actually be easier to ride and more fun to ride. So
Yeah, plus they look good.
Yeah.
They get that aggressive line, a little bit more aggressive than the trail bike. So it gets that almost a downhill look, but you don't have to deal with all the squish.
Yeah, that's true.
So do you get to ride a lot? I mean, now that you're running the company and you're building bikes, are you still getting to get out on them? That's one of those things, right? You got to find the balance.
Yeah.
You're still riding.
Oh, yeah. I'm very lucky to live on a place where riding is good. In the very south of Germany. During the week it's sometimes not as easy, but on the weekends I go normally a lot on like 2-day trips in the Alps, and I still get to do a lot of riding. That's definitely something that I hope will never be compromised.
I hope not. That's one of the perks of making bikes, I would imagine, is going out and riding them.
Yeah, it's been like I said, now since spring the bikes have been out there, and in the last few months there have been some cases where I met raw owners somewhere in a bike resort or bike park or in the trails, and that's definitely the best part of it.
That's really cool,
actually riding the bikes and meeting people and seeing that they're stoked about it. And that's
where good. Are they selling so far?
So technically I'm able to sell worldwide, but because of product liability reasons, not in the US and Canada, which is definitely a bummer. But reality is just that I'm it's just a lot of work, and also financially quite a big thing to be able to sell in the US and Canada. So it's high on my priority list, but for now it's not possible. But I can definitely see that the sales are mainly around in the south of Germany and around here. So UK is quite strong. I think in the UK, it's a bike that people like, probably because of the, let's say, like the durability features on it.
Yeah, and you usually see things start to happen where they're made locally. So you'll sell the most right where you are in the first couple of years, and that starts to expand, and then more people hear about it, and more people become aware of it, and eventually you get into the other markets. But most of the people I've talked to, it started with just their general location and people and friends and word of mouth, and it gets better and better and keeps moving. Now I'm ignorant to it, so I don't know what makes it so hard to sell bikes in the US and Canada versus Europe and other places.
The main reason is just the insurance rate. So for the rest of the world, it's not very expensive to have a product liability insurance. So let's say for a very worst case. But insurance companies here in Germany, for a part, don't even offer it for US and Canada, and with others, it's just very expensive. They probably take the risk to be hired, but it's also a topic that I need to dive into a bit more. It's just not been an easy one for the past year, and yeah,
I'd like to know more about it too. I'll have to dig in. It's interesting. I'd like to understand that deeper. So I wonder if it's because you're importing, or like I wonder if the companies, the American companies that are making bikes, I wonder if they just have to deal with a higher liability, or I wonder if you could buy from an American, or at least one that sells in America, an insurance company, to get better rates than maybe a German company that doesn't want to carry the policies in America. I wonder what's behind it is really.
Definitely sounds like that could be a good idea to see. But yeah, that's also just the whole process of finding that out. So it's just one of those things that I had to put on hold because it wasn't really that easy for the first year. That's where I decided I generally decided to take one step after the other. So there are some more things that I would like to do. Like right now, I can only offer frame kits, so that's a frame with a shock and some essential parts. But one of the things I really want to be able to do is to sell complete bikes next year.
So what's the difference? What do you have to do to go from selling frame kits to completes? What's that look like for the business owner? Don't give out any secrets. I'm just curious.
I think there are different ways of doing it, but if it is the, let's say, like the classic way of how all bike companies would do it, it means that you need to purchase all components in advance and plan it. And it's, to me, I think it is pretty much would be a full-time job to do that. And it would simply need the money to be able to finance it all.
That's what I was guessing. It's probably it's logistics, right? Because if you're like you said, you made 100 frames and you sold them out, but of course you didn't know if you were going to sell them out, and you already gambled on the 100 frames, and you're not a 15-year-old company that's selling millions of bikes yet. So
exactly,
the gamble is to move to the full bikes. Basically, you have to buy all the bikes and then sell them, right? And then you're sitting on inventory if you don't. How does that work in mountain biking? If you were sitting on inventory, like let's say you were going to do 200 bikes next year and you bought 200 bikes worth of all the extra components, and let's say you sold 100, can you use those components the following year, or does everyone release new stuff and they're supposed to be model year when they come out?
Yeah, that's definitely a tough one. I don't really think in model years with the frame as a product, but definitely a lot of products are. So let's say like the Fox shocks that I use are of course a certain model year, so that means that next year they're old, or like last year's. So that's definitely, that goes with a high risk. It's a big one. So I'm currently more looking at different options of, let's say, like outsourcing it and being able to offer complete bikes, maybe not at the best price points. I'm not going to be able to compete with the big brands like Canyon and YT when it's about pricing, but that's also not going to be the aim of it. But I think for me and for the company, it's going to be important to be able to offer it in some way, because I can see that there are a lot of people that just like to do it all themselves. They get the frame kit and they either already have parts from a previous bike, or they know exactly what they want to buy and build.
Yeah, of course.
Then there are also people that really like it, but like to rely on the components that we would choose and that we would build up. So,
And there's companies out there that have made their name on frames that don't even get into doing full bikes. They just sell frames. They do a great job with the frames, and that's what they're content doing.
Yeah. But I can definitely see that there are a lot of people that get in contact with me and that would like to get a full bike because they like it, but they don't yeah, they just don't see it happening, building the complete bike. And it is not, I mean, if you spend a lot of time on bikes and understanding it all and all the standards and what's available on the market, it's cool, but it's so big. It's such a big jungle of standards.
And yeah, it's very confusing.
That, yeah. So I can understand that there are a lot of people that are more afraid of building a bike than, yeah, looking forward to it.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, there's a lot of moving parts that go into it. And like I said earlier, it's an expensive investment. It's not cheap. So if you mess it up, or if you're, you know, you don't want all the pressure on you. You want someone else to have already made smart decisions. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned it's hard to compete on price with Canyon or YT. And I mean, I've heard that from companies that are bigger than yours too, that they're, you know, in the middle, somewhere between you and the YTs of the world. What is that just a different way to compete? I mean, what do you think about, so then what do? You have to put yourself more on, like, focus on the durability and make a name in one specific thing. How do you come out from underneath that? Because the YT, the Canyons, they make great bikes. People love them. You know, people get excited about them. So it's not like it's a discount bike that's no good, right? They make good products. So then is it a niche for smaller guys like you that are doing really, you know, really custom special bike builds? Is it you just got to find your own little place?
For a part, probably yes. I mean, but I think there are also, I mean, big brands like YT and Canyon definitely make good bikes. There's no question. They ride really well. But there are still so many details on the frame and details on suspension, geometry, and how everything's balanced, how that works for taller riders. There's so many things that I think can be done better. And with the Madonna, it's like one way of trying to make that happen in a frame. So it's definitely about details. I think it's possible to make better products. But for, let's say, like specific target groups, for specific usage. So there are a lot of chances. And I can see that there are a lot of people that appreciate that and that are willing to spend a bit more on something that,
that might suit them and their specific needs.
Yeah, I think that's also one of the biggest advantages for a small brand like Raw, is that I don't need to make a bike that suits everyone. Whereas a big brand, of course, would always aim for that. And I think that is one of the reasons why it, to me, will always be some sort of a compromise. So those bikes are good. Those bikes are fine, but there will always be a compromise in some way.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. With the Madonna, I tried to communicate that it really is a bike designed to go fast. So if that is something you like, it will be great. If you like more, let's say, like technical riding where you move your rear wheel a lot, and it's not going to be the bike that fits you best. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy that I can communicate that, because I also don't need to reach a really big audience.
Right. So I see on the site, you've got a whole bunch of reviews, like from Mountain Bike and Enduro and Pink Bike. Mm-hmm. So people have ridden the bike. Tell me about that. So then what? So people ride the bike, and then a good article gets published, like the one in Enduro. And then what happens?
Oh, sometimes it's a week ago, 2 weeks ago, a review on Mountain Bike News got online, which is it's in Germany, it's very big, and the amount of views and clicks is just is crazy. And you can definitely, it's crazy how many emails and messages, phone calls get in after that. You can definitely see, I mean, also on Google Analytics, looking at the website, it's crazy, but it's really cool. And sometimes you can even see that if the brand only gets mentioned somewhere on some website, you can already see a peak in, let's say, like the complete communication. So that's definitely a very cool thing. And especially here in Germany, with the review from Mountain Bike News last week, that is something that helps me a lot, just in a way of reaching people and getting people's attention on the product.
I bet it does. Has it done anything to spur sales? I mean, like, at one point, did you have 100 frames ordered? and not exactly know how you're going to unload them. And then you get a good review and suddenly there's orders you weren't expecting. Did any of that happen to you, or was it all more of a careful progress?
I think it helps a little bit. Yes. Like right now, a little bit of stock left. So you can see that some more orders come in, but I think the purchasing a frame kit like this, that is definitely not cheap, is for most people a process. So I think it just helps in that process. So it's not like an immediate, it doesn't translate immediate to sales, but it just helps in the process of maybe purchasing a product. And most people that eventually get to buying a frame kit will always send at least 5 to 10 emails or make some phone calls, or I also offer test rides here in Germany, which is something I also very much like. I like to get into the conversation with people and explain the product, and
plus you get to ride if you're out on a test ride with them.
Oh yeah, that's very good. I just did a weekend, Saturday and Sunday, of test rides in Black Forest in Germany, with two stacked days of riding. So yeah,
nice.
I did underestimate a little bit how much riding it meant for me, but it was very good.
Well, yeah, that's a good thing. It keeps you riding, keeps you active. Like we were saying, it's one of those important parts. So I think what I'm hearing, it makes sense, is it's not that the good articles spur sales immediately, but what they do is they get people thinking about you that didn't otherwise know that RAW was out there.
Yeah, and I think it helps them in the decision-making process. Definitely the thoughts that go into a certain review will also be then a topic to talk about. And I think it just helps in people maybe wanting the product or not.
What are those initial conversations like? You say that someone's going to buy a bike, it's 5 or 10 emails and a conversation and a test ride. And what are you, are you trying to help make sure it's the right type of bike for them? That it's, you know, like you said, it's for going fast. Are you trying to make sure that tell me how that goes?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is also, for example, about, the sizing of the bike. So I offer three sizes, medium, large, extra large. And that is, for example, a very interesting thing, because say like 10 years ago, sizing would be just about your body height. So you would just say, it just depends on that. And right now it depends so much more on what you expect from the bike and what riding style you have, and what kind of trails you ride. A lot of people can always choose between two sizes, and then it's a lot more a question of what kind of riding do you do, what do you want to use it for, what stem length fits on it for that riding, for the right seated position. So there are a lot of details on the product itself.
I've seen a lot of that lately, where the more sizes are offered and you can pick between two that might suit you for your height, right? So how do you decide which one? What would be the consideration if, let's say, we're somewhere in the middle between a medium and a large, or a large and extra large? How do you decide which one's right?
Well, the best thing is, of course, to ride both sizes. But I think a lot of people can also just they can decide for themselves depending on their riding. Like for me, I ride a size large, but I can also ride an extra large. Mm-hmm. When I ride an extra large, I can feel that it's fast, like really fast, and probably if I'd be just racing, that would be the bike for me. Mm-hmm. But then every time I hop back on the large, it's just a lot more fun. I can feel that coming out of a berm, it's just a lot more fun. So it's a little bit that thing of stability and speed versus still being able to just play with the bike.
Right, it's more then, nimble if it's a little bit smaller. You can throw it around a lot easier.
There are also people that just really enjoy having that stability and just going fast, and that are fine with the compromise of maybe having a bike that is a bit boring. So, that is I think mainly the process of getting to the right size. And then there are also three shock options, two air shocks and one coil shock. So that also changes the character of the bike a lot.
What does that do for a character? Let's say the air versus the coil.
So in that's specific to the Madonna frame. So that's not, let's say, like not a general thing to all full suspension bikes, but on the Madonna, with the air shocks, with both air shocks, air shock options, the bike feels a bit more aggressive and a bit more active. Mm-hmm. With the coil shock, it sits a little bit deeper into the travel. It uses a bit more travel on the same impact. So if you are pedaling more, the air shock is definitely giving the bike a little bit more, I'd say an active character to it. Whereas if you use it pretty much as a downhill bike, some people live somewhere where they have lift access all the time. And if you like that, let's say like slack feeling of the bike, that the BB is low, the head angle gets a little bit slacker, then the coil stroke is definitely the better choice.
And then just going back to where we first started, I have a question. Mm-hmm. You are an engineer, you worked for bike companies, and so this is kind of designing a bike fits pretty well what your background is. Did you ever fabricate any of the pieces? Were you building prototypes, or you're an engineer, did you find, mm-hmm. I know you have a new factory in Taiwan, I guess I'm asking, did it lead to that, or did you have to find a factory first in order to build your designs? How did that work?
I think in my case, I'm very thankful for the production company that I found in Taiwan, because it's definitely, there is a lot that they added to the process, to the development process. I mean, I'd love to have prototyping at where I am and being able to weld frames and to do things, to make changes quickly for testing. But having a partner in Taiwan that is good and has a lot of experience with, of course, also a lot of other brands, is definitely something that helps a lot.
Oh, I bet you bring expertise that you don't have to the table.
Oh yeah. And I mean, I do have a couple of years of experience in the bike industry, but yeah, the experience they bring is great. That's definitely something that has been a key thing in the whole process, especially when it's about wall thickness of aluminium and the exact material that they use. They've been through it all. So if in theory I somehow would have built a production line here in Germany, that would have taken years probably to get to the same standard.
Right. Kind of barking up the wrong tree or just going uphill.
Yeah.
And you build in aluminum, right? That's your weapon of choice. What can you tell me about that? Why do you go with aluminum? I know people have an opinion on steel. They have an opinion on aluminum. Mm-hmm. They have an opinion on carbon. Some people think you got to pick one. Some people do all three. Why did you land on aluminum?
I think, first reason is that is, the weight and durability of the material. So I think that, like I said, with an enduro bike, it shouldn't be too light. So that already is reason enough for me to not go to carbon fiber. Mm-hmm. And the thing I like about aluminium is that you can, the production process of hydroforming, forging, is something that gives a lot of freedom in the whole design process.
Freedom for shaping and for it's pretty cool, you have things hidden in the frame as far as gear and things you need with you on the road, like toolkits. I think that's pretty interesting, and you I'm guessing you couldn't do that with carbon fiber because you wouldn't have
exactly. So on one hand, I wanted to keep the design of the frame very clean, like very functional, because I think it's a functional product, so it doesn't really need something more than what it needs. But there are so many details, like you said, like there's a little bit of space for a storage of a tube and a CO2 cartridge in the down tube, that is done with a recess in the down tube that also helps for clearance for the piggyback of the shark. And it's been a bit of a challenge to actually get that shape out of a hydroforming mold, but it's possible. And that, for example, would be really hard with steel.
So you just you wouldn't have the flexibility in shapes, I'm guessing.
Yeah. So that is why I think that for an enduro bike, for me, it's the best material. But then, and also, if you had impacts from rocks or from a crash, it's just risks are a little bit lower. Even if you have a dent in the down tube, it's all right. And of course, it doesn't look good, but it's not as
ruined.
Undefined as with carbon fiber, where it's always very hard to tell what happens.
I hear about that a lot, but I don't see a lot of broken carbon fiber bikes. Do you come across a lot of people that break their bikes?
It's hard to say, it's very subjective probably, but it happens. And yeah. I think it's also a mental thing. If you know that after a crash and you see a little dent in your aluminium bike, it's shit, but it's all right.
Right.
And with a carbon fiber bike, it's a thing that's always in the back of your head.
Yeah. Now you're wondering, do I need a new frame?
Yeah. It's the same for me with rim choice. Like, of course, a carbon fiber rims can be very cool in a way. Like what Envy does is very interesting and cool, but I just like to know that I've got some aluminium rims that can get a dent and that are not very expensive if I need to swap them. So
I always think about that with debating on new bikes on aluminum or carbon, and mm-hmm. you know, people always go back and forth with the strength and the carbon braking, but it being lighter. And I don't know where I sit on it, you know, because I wouldn't want to worry about the carbon braking. But then again, I don't really come across people if they were just braking all the time and it didn't work, then they wouldn't make carbon bikes.
Oh yeah.
Except that it is cheaper to manufacture carbon bikes, right? So the people that are making larger runs, they're saving money because the carbon mm-hmm. bikes are cheaper to make, but they charge more for them.
Yeah. But I would also not say that would be the biggest reason not to choose carbon fiber. Like I said, like for a cross country bike or a road bike, or maybe even a trail bike where it's just more fun to have a light bike that mm-hmm. feels like, it accelerates better. It can definitely be the better choice, but then for an enduro bike that is nearly capable of doing what a downhill bike does, I think it doesn't really make sense. So
yeah. So did you have to spend a lot of time in Taiwan getting things up and running, getting the bikes and the frames exactly the way they're supposed to be?
I've been there now in the period of doing raw. I've been there now 3 times. So it's I think it depends on the production company you work with. I'm of course in contact pretty much on a daily basis with the company, just with Skype and email. They definitely take care of a lot of things very well, and they are very aware of the quality that the product needs to have. That's also why a certain price tag is on it. But
of course, that's the way it goes. You got to pay for quality. But it's also, you know, you need to know what you're selling, right? So you need to know that you're getting that quality, because you're in turn going to sell that frame to somebody, and it's mm-hmm. your name that's on it. So you got to make sure.
Oh yeah, that's definitely been one of the very exciting things in the beginning of the whole process, in finding a company that, I mean, yeah, it's very far away from where I live, and at some point it feels a little bit crazy to have that kind of a relationship with a company that's in the other end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's the thing of a relation with a company that also needs to grow, and it already got to a point where it's really cool, and then they're also open a lot for discussions and also future ideas on the production process.
And also I gotta imagine that part of it too, we talked earlier how you can't compete with YT and Canyon on absolute bottom pricing, but you also can't be the most expensive bike, because there's bikes with bigger names and proven past. And if you're going up against them, then it's going to be a tough road to go against, like the Yeti, the bikes that are the most expensive, but they have a long name. And I think one of the differences therein, correct me if I'm wrong, but bikes like Yeti, where it's made in America, or, and I'm sure there's the equivalent in Germany and all over the place where they make it locally and they make a big deal out of that. That drives up production costs, though. Like Yetis certainly cost more to make than a YT or than anyone that manufactures overseas. Like even American bikes like Transition that make awesome bikes, but they don't manufacture them here in the US, right? They do it overseas and they bring them over. So that is a way to keep the quality. From what I've seen, you keep the quality, but you're able to bring the cost down a little bit to the consumer so that you have a window to discuss, you know, why should I ride a Raw versus a Yeti? Because you don't want to be up where they're at in pricing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely a good and interesting question. I think it depends maybe also a little bit on the quantity. I think in my case, something I'm also very open about is that I'm just very happy to have the production company in Taiwan as a partner in the way of what they add to the whole process and to the product. But it's probably something that is different when a company has a bigger size, when it's not about 100 frames or 200 or 500, but when it's going to be 5,000 or 10,000 frames, that is definitely going to be, the pricing is going to be a bigger thing. And yeah, but yeah, that's definitely also something that I'm still far away from what I'm doing now. So I'm mainly just very happy to be there. And in Germany, there are two or three bike companies that produce in Germany, but they, which is a very cool thing and something I really like. But they also don't have the same production process as what companies in Taiwan can offer. The companies in Taiwan, they are just so advanced, and they are good. It's, if you just look at the quality of the product, it's going to be hard to find something that is better than what they can do.
Well, right, because you're buying into their scale. So, you know, you're making 100 bikes, someone else is making 100 bikes, someone else is making 2,000, someone else is making 6,000, and these guys can produce it all. They're producing from multiple different brands. So they've got the production level of the huge company that's making 10,000 frames.
Yeah.
But they can pass on that efficiency to you and then you to your consumer. That's kind of what I was talking about, where, you know, if you're there's nothing wrong with it at all. And that's not what I'm trying to say, but with the local production, I think it's great. And there's a certain local pride and all of that's cool, but it's definitely going to drive up costs because the labor is going to be more expensive. You're investing in this one run thing. Like if you're only going to make your bikes, that's very different than the factory in Taiwan that's got 24 hour shifts running for multiple different companies. And they just have to change out the molds and their equipment and they're still busy. So there's almost no way to compete with that, which is, you know, that's how the whole offshoring thing started, not just in mountain bikes, but in general.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely true. It's an interesting thing that especially in Taiwan, that there are so many companies all based in Taiwan, that the industry, production industry and the bike industry grew so much over there. And there is a trend of production companies moving to other countries in Asia where it's cheaper to produce just for the big masses. But in some way it say like the high quality frame production all got to Taiwan.
Well, there's a balance, right? There's a balance between the cost savings and the communication and the attention to detail that sometimes the cheaper you go, if you're really hunting for that, you lose some of the things that like you're saying, that they bring to the table with the expertise and the constant communications and helping to get things right.
Yeah.
So you got the Madonna and it looks like an awesome bike and people are enjoying it. And you said you're sold out of some of the models. And so what's next? Are you going to do more? Are you going to get into trail bikes? Are you going to have different bikes? What do you think's coming down the road for you?
Well, So in restock is coming in winter. And those frames are going to be just identical to the first batch. And I do have plans and ideas for future projects, and it's definitely the goal to get a second frame or a second bike in the lineup. But that is definitely something that will earliest be available in, let's say, like 1.5 or 2 years or something. And that is also, I prefer to just stay one step after the other. So I'm very happy that everything went well in the last year. I've got a lot of ideas also for, I'd like to call it a Madonna V2. So like, just the V2 of the frame, but that is also something that is going to be presented earliest in 1.5, 2 years.
Yeah, but that's something you're starting to think about and you're kicking around ideas. Yeah. I'm sure you've probably got sketches. What is it a secret what you want to do with the V2, or do you have things that you want to address specifically, or just new ideas?
No, it's also still there are a lot of ideas on the production process, on the way of having the aluminium construction that I'm working on, and that I need to make samples and prototypes and see if it works or not. So it's still just like that, just the development process. So there's, we'll see what then eventually be taken into a V2. But that's also the part that I personally really like coming from mechanical engineering. That's definitely the bit that excites me most. But it's hard to say what exactly will end up in the next frame. But that's also, I think, that's definitely part of the process of developing products.
The whole production looks really fun. I'm looking at the website right now, the mm-hmm. New factory page. I assume this is you in some of these pictures.
Yeah.
The pictures are really cool. It would be fun to spend a few days here. There's a picture here where they've got a frame locked on some squared off forks. It looks like it's probably a durability tester where it's putting mm-hmm. the frame under stress. It just looks fun. It'd be fun to hang out and see how all the different pieces work and how it comes together.
Oh yeah, and that definitely that I did that story on the production company in Taiwan, the one you're probably now looking at, and mm-hmm. that was definitely one of the best things ever. Just after a year, 1.5 year of developing the product, getting the first frame, and just seeing it come together and see the single parts of the frame, all the forging and hydroforming parts, and then the frame actually being born, and that you can hold it after looking at a screen for a year. That was something really cool.
Come to life. That is cool.
Yeah. So that was also one of the things that I decided that I wanted. I got a photographer in Taiwan to get that photo story done, because I think I just wanted to show the company that I work with. Because it seems that for a lot of people, production in Asia is like this kind of secret thing where no one really knows what it looks like or how it's done. That's one of the things that I wanted to just show everything in the whole process.
Well, it's a good move to get the pictures and to tell the story and to be transparent, because I run a marketing firm focused on adventure sports, right? And mm-hmm. the fact is that slick marketing and trying to fool people just doesn't work anymore. The marketing nowadays is all about creating authentic relationships with you and the people who are going to ride your bikes or your boards or whatever it is that you make. And it's mm-hmm. a two-way street. You know, it's to open it up and to show them what you're all about is how you connect with people. I think it's a really smart move. People don't, it's no longer the slick, you know, used car salesman or the commercial that says, get down and buy now or you're running out of time. That stuff's gone. Nobody reacts well to that. In fact, that turns people off. It's now much different. And especially in the adventure sport world where you've got like surfing and snowboarding and skating and mountain biking, people, almost more than other markets, they're very finicky and they're really turned off by marketing or being too corporate, right? I mean, even even in like snowboarding, people almost roll their eyes at companies like Burton just because they're big. You know, they're great. They build fantastic boards. They have great R&D departments, but it's almost like, well, you got big, you're not cool. And so you have to be really careful. And I think things like this show, you know, it shows you out making it happen. It shows you hands-on, putting the bike together, having it come to life. I think it's smart. You should keep it up.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. I think I just, in all things, that one of the key words for me is just to be real with everything, not act about anything, but just show the real process of how everything's happening. So that's also one of the things I'm definitely thinking of, how to communicate more in videos.
Have you got to ride places that you wouldn't have otherwise gotten to ride because of like say Pink Bike or somebody doing a story on the bikes and invites you to go on a ride? Has that helped open up new awesome places you wouldn't have gone, or were you already riding everywhere you would have?
You mean in general, or
in general, just like has it?
Oh, yeah, my girlfriend also rides a lot, and even today I sent her a link of a story about some region in France that we've never been to that looked really, really good. Something that is probably about 6-7 hours from here, so maybe worth going for a weekend.
Mm-hmm.
That is, I think, one of the nice things about where I live is that within that range of 6-7 hours drive, there are so many different places to go. From Italy to France, it's just so many different types of terrains and trails and like high alpine or
no reason to get bored. He's a lot to do.
Oh, no, definitely not.
Yeah, I haven't been riding in Europe. I think it's fairly similar here where there's a lot of different terrain. If you go state to state, you know, Colorado is very different than Vermont, very different than California or Washington, but it's probably similar. But I'd like to ride everywhere personally. I just want to keep going new places and experience.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And that's probably also one of the great things that is happening here in the past 3 years is that so many resorts, like ski resorts in the Alps, turn into amazing bike resorts in summer. It's pretty cool.
That's getting more and more prevalent here too, where a few years ago there might have been one local park and now I could probably go to, you know, 10 within an hour drive. And they're all great parks and they're I don't know, they're just good deals. They're really built well, and they're, like you said, they're mostly being built around ski resorts. So they're making use of all the nature during the off season, which is, I think, really cool.
Yeah, definitely.
Is there anything I didn't bring up that you want to talk about regarding the company or mountain biking in general? Anything you want to get into? I don't want it to be all me.
I don't know. It's Raw has been just a crazy journey in the past 2 years, especially because like in the first year it was all quiet and behind the scenes, and in the past year it has been with a lot of coverage online, and I don't know. The Raw experience itself has been really cool. Definitely also, like I said, a lot of learning things in it. I don't know if there is something else you'd like to talk about.
I've got one more question.
I think I might be a little bit overwhelmed with all the questions, like also said, as first time I'm doing a podcast, so
sorry about that. Yep. Just try to keep things. I'm just asking about what I'm curious about, so it keeps things moving along.
No worries,
I do have another question. The Madonna's 29, right?
Yeah.
How did you decide on that? Because I hear that 27.5 is more popular in Europe, although the 29 is gaining popularity. Where like here in the US, the 29s are more popular. So how did you land on that?
Well, I I wrote a few different 29er bikes, let's say like 2, 3, 4 years ago. And I remember that one of the bikes was a Trek Slash about 3 years ago. And I just, the thing I will never forget is how much grip in like open corners those tires had. I was just, I knew immediately that that was, I wouldn't want to go back to smaller wheels. And I don't know, maybe people here are a little bit more conservative, so maybe it took a tiny little bit longer. But yeah, especially on large and extra large riders, there are people don't really ask anymore why 29 inch. It's definitely something that has settled in the bike community here as well.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, I prefer it too. I was just curious how you landed on which one you were going to make.
Yeah, it's also something I probably have been, I mean, raw being small, I've been lucky that over the past 2 years that it got to this point where I don't really need to explain why 29er, because I remember 2 years ago when I would tell friends about the, let's say like the concept of the Madonna frame, they would be like, are you sure about 29 inch wheels? And yeah, that's definitely something that changed really quick. Right now it's normal, but about 2, 3 years ago people would be very skeptical about it.
It's good to see it coming to be normal.
Yeah,
just in my opinion, because I like it better. It's good to see that.
Yeah, I think only the only thing on, because right now I offer medium, large and extra large frame sizes, and it's just, it's hard to fit big wheels with a lot of travel in a small sized frame or even a extra small sized frame. That's something that where I think that maybe it needs to compromise with a little bit smaller wheels.
Or is that why travel. Is that why you stopped at the medium, because the small just wouldn't perform right?
Exactly. So I worked on a small, but I decided that it was too much of a compromise. Because everything just gets very, very compact, because you need to imagine that, I mean, the rear wheel moves up 16 centimeters and the saddle needs to go somewhere if it's dropped. There's not much space. Even on a medium, it's all very tight. Also things like chainstay length. You don't want a back end that's too long on a small sized frame. Yeah, but it could either be on a small size frame, you could either have a little bit less travel or smaller wheels. But yeah, I think that is definitely something where it is a little bit limited. But other than that, I don't see a reason to not ride 29ers.
So coming out of that photo shoot on the factory in Taiwan, is that the first time you assembled and rode a Madonna?
Yeah. Well, yeah, we assembled the frame there in Taiwan and then flew home and built up the bike. And, well, that was very exciting.
Yeah, I bet. Well, I mean, what does that feel like to actually put some wheels on it, get all the gear on it, and pedal away?
It's crazy. And also because there are so many components that all need to fit. And there are, I mean, it's all very, very tight. And with the boost standards on the drivetrain and the tire clearance and everything, it's just it was kind of scary to build it up and to see if it would actually all fit. And I actually made a small mistake in the brake mount where the bolts of the rotor did touch the brake mount, so we had to change that a little bit. And of course there were some more small details on it, but just have the majority of all, let's say, like clearances of the frame, have that work. And and then riding it the first day is also something I probably never forget.
I bet it was scary. I bet it was scary as hell assembling the first one, just like with each piece, like please fit. No matter how much time and work you put into it, there's always room for error, and there's always room, you know, there's going to be a first model that's going to have bugs, then it's going to
we've also been through three prototype stages, sort of been a lot of details, especially also on hardware, on the tolerances of all the axles of the bolts and everything. That is There were some moments where it was maybe even like a little bit too much. I think there are so many details on a bike frame that when it works and when it fits, it is normal. It's like, yeah, of course it works. Of course it's that way. But if it's not, it's it all needs to come together. And no matter how much time you spend on 3D files and working everything out, it's the moment of truth when you build up the first bike. But
and then you finally get that first one built and you pedal off on it. And how does it feel? Was it different than anything you ever rode? Was it, can you describe it, what it was like?
I think that is an interesting thing, because going through the development process, there were a lot of details on the bike, let's say on the geometry and the suspension, that I worked on and that I expected to feel when riding. But the balance of what you would feel most was different than expected. For example, the seated position, so like the seat angle being very steep, was something that I decided that pretty early on in the process, and that was it. So I didn't really think about it.
Mm-hmm.
But that is something that stood out straight away so much, and that it was so good to pedal up. Whereas, for example, details on a suspension design is something that you can feel, but that maybe I expected to be more present in the riding.
Yeah.
So that's been an interesting thing. But then, it also took me a couple of rides to realize that I was riding that bike.
Very cool. I bet it was a good day.
Yeah, it was.
I bet it was
in Italy. We'll not forget.
No, I can't imagine you would. I mean, I think it's awesome. You brought something to life. That's why I like having this show. You know, I get to meet and talk to people that make things. And I enjoy that. Like, I make skateboards in my garage with my kids, and we work on them together, and we built the mold and we build the boards. And it's just, I like creating. And the idea of creating a mountain bike is well beyond me. It's too many parts and it's metal and I don't know how to do it, but I think it's awesome. And I just love to, I mean, you made this happen. You went from an idea in your head to a bike you can actually ride on a trail. That's awesome. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely a very, very cool process. And at some points it can be very long and it takes so many hours of working on just in theory on a computer, but just then getting to a trail. And like I said, meeting people riding the bike on a trail is something that is very, very cool.
I can't imagine how cool that feels, seeing a raw bike at a park or something and not even knowing the person. That's gotta be a good feeling.
Yeah. Recently, a few weeks ago, we met two Italian guys on a raw. That was just very cool. Just in a different country with people that,
Yeah. I imagine there's a few feelings like it, you know, it's just, wow.
Yeah. So,
and on that note,
crazy but good.
it's really cool. On that note, Ruben, congratulations on everything so far. I'm going to keep checking you out and seeing how things come to bear in the future with the version 2 and if you get into new bikes. I hope you stay in touch. We could always do this again. I mean, it's nice to just see how things are coming along, and I appreciate you taking the time today.
Yeah, thank you very much as well. It's been a pleasure. It's cool.
Yeah, it's been fun.